open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
There wasn't really a desire to write the book. It felt like an obligation, and it was an obligation to the truth that was disappearing.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Eric Fair says his Christian faith led him to question his role as an interrogator in Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison.
The immediate recognition was that throughout Scripture, God is always on the side of those who are in prison. And there are no scenes within Scripture in which God is siding with the jailer. And I spent the next year or two trying to swallow that feeling and push it down. That was the beginning of what really became a conflict.
Eric Fair worked as a contract interrogator at Abu Ghraib in 2004. That year, photographs depicting torture at the prison were leaked to the public. Fair was not involved in that incident, but did use interrogation techniques such as sleep deprivation and stress positions. He wrote his book, Consequence, a Memoir, in an attempt to come to terms with his actions. Fair talks this hour with retired General Michael Leonard, a Marine Corps veteran who was the first commander of the Guantanamo prison. Leonard asked Fair how he came to his current position about the use of torture.
My position changes in many ways on almost a daily basis. I arrived in Iraq in 2004, and a minute-by-minute kind of evolution of the way I thought about what was going on ensued. I wrote my first article in 2007. I did not use the word torture back in 2007. I was simply talking about enhanced interrogation. It took me a few years to start using the word torture and to essentially start calling myself a torturer. And even as I do that, I know that I'm implicating some of my former colleagues and some of my very close friends in what is essentially a federal crime. And so there are still days as I continue to process what I have done and what I saw others did and what we as a nation did, that I still question exactly what it was and how to label all of it.
Okay. Well, you know, you open Consequence with a quote from Maimonides, the 12th century Jewish philosopher, scientist, and poet. And the quote goes, "A person is not forgiven until he pays back his fellow man what he owes him and appeases him. He must placate him and approach him again and again until he is forgiven." By writing this book, were you looking for forgiveness?
No, the book was never a pursuit of forgiveness. And it's interesting, I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a few years ago, and it was about, I was teaching at Lehigh University, and I was teaching working with students, and some of them had not heard about Abu Ghraib, and others had, and so we were talking about how we needed to process through that. And when I submitted the op-ed to the New York Times, the title was written for me, which was, I Can't Be Forgiven for Abu Ghraib. Now, the word forgiveness never appeared in the op-ed, and that was not my intention. But when we start talking about war, and when we start talking about torture and what people did, the redemption narrative and the forgiveness narrative immediately kind of sneaks in there.
Sure does.
That was not my intention. This narrative is not about forgiveness. It's not about redemption. I'm not hoping that in some ways that maybe I meet former prisoners down the line and that they forgive. Yeah. This was simply back in 2006 when I finished my second tour in Iraq, and the narrative was completely different than what my life experience had been. We had not heard about the Senate torture report at that time. The Vice President of the United States had not talked about waterboarding. But at this point, they were still denying that waterboarding had taken place. So it was many in the audience probably remember 2005, 2006. It was a much different country. And I was racked probably with issues like guilt and conscience, but also many of the values that I'd picked up in the Army about speaking truth. And so there wasn't really a desire to write the book. In fact, in many ways, I did not want to start writing. It felt like an obligation, and it was an obligation to the truth that was disappearing.
Well, you know, you mentioned values, Eric, and you grew up in Pennsylvania in a dying steel mill town. Both of your grandfathers fought in World War II. Both of your parents were school teachers. You were active in the Presbyterian Church. You attended a small Christian college. You became a cop. By any standards, your upbringing represented what we'd call around here typical Midwestern values. So what did you see in Iraq that challenged those values?
Well, everything challenges those values. And I think, having grown up as a devout Christian, it was interesting that when I chose to join the Army in 1995, there was no one in my church that had anything negative to say about that. So I was immediately encouraged. It was considered a wonderful thing, and But there was no one, and the Presbyterian Church does not have a pacifist strain, but there was no one who suggested that I might want to think about the Gospels in a more critical manner, or some of the things that we were studying in a more critical manner. So the military was really seen as just kind of this natural progression, and it was easy to marry the two, faith and religion. And in many ways, and I'm sure you can speak to this, the military felt in many ways like a faith community. There was always a sense of you worried about other people more than you worried about yourself. You know, there's a classic thing in the Army, when the Army goes out into the field and it needs to eat, that the leaders eat last, right? And they wait to make sure that the younger troops are fed. And so your concern is always in the military about the people around you more than it is about yourself. And so it was a very familiar sort of community. It wasn't until that I saw what the Army and what the military was designed for that it really started to come up against some of those faith values that I had. And it started in Iraq right from the start, not with enhanced interrogation and not with torture, but just seeing the large number of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, and the numbers were anywhere between 7,000 and 12,000. And it was immediate to me, and my knowledge, I mean, Presbyterians, I was required to have a decent knowledge of Scripture. The immediate recognition was that throughout Scripture, God is always on the side of those who are imprisoned, right? That's and there right. are no scenes within Scripture in which God is siding with the jailer or the prisoner. And that was really, and I remember that moment right. sitting down considering that, and that was where it started. And I spent the next year or two, trying to swallow that feeling and push it down. But that was the beginning of what really became a conflict.
Well, you know, in Eric, in the book, moving before actually you got to Iraq, you enlisted in the Army and you became an Arab linguist. You attended Defense Language School in Monterey. And, I think by some standards, perhaps uninformed standards, that prepared you well to become an interrogator. But would you tell us a little bit about your Army career that you had, which occurred, for the benefit of the audience, before 9/11. I mean, this was a military that was not at war, and you were selected because of your linguistic talent. But what do you get in the Army when you become a linguist?
Well, the Army sends you to, well, first the Army determines whether or not you have the aptitude to learn a language.
Right.
And once they do that, they send you to the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. Year and a half of Arabic training, at which point you're then sent into your specific military job. And the vast majority of us went into what was known as signals intelligence, which is largely sitting with headphones and listening to intercept. And a very small percentage were sent into what's known as human intelligence, which is interrogation. And so the Army in general, and this was true for the Marine Corps too, and sure. the Air Force and the Navy, who did the same thing, did not have as much human intelligence or interrogators as they did signals intelligence and electronic intelligence. So the military in general was never prepared to interrogate or deal with enormous numbers of prisoners of war. It was designed largely for limited operations. So when the Iraq War started, I was a police officer at this point. The Army and the military in general was desperate to find a supply of interrogators to interrogate these enormous number of prisoners that were being captured.
And as you said, you know, you left the Army in 2000. You meet Karen, your wife. 2002, you begin training as a police officer. You apply for a job with the DEA, and during your final physical, you're told you have cardiomyopathy. Not only can't you be a DEA agent, you can't be a police officer any longer. You need work, so you apply for a job as a contractor. And can you tell us about that process, just what went on? You know, you're suddenly, you know, your career is pretty much, at least in the direction yeah. you were headed, has been derailed.
So I had, from an early age, Presbyterians interpret what's known as a calling, right? Yeah. This idea that God has a calling on your life, and it is often directed towards vocation. And my calling from an early age felt like law enforcement. Not something I can explain, it was something I wanted to do. And I worked my way through the Army and through college, and I eventually got that job as a police officer and lost it and was devastated. And I took a job, actually prior to even becoming a contractor, I took a job with the National Security Agency. And these were incredibly long ordeals in terms of getting these jobs. Ready. You know, there's a form called the SF-76 Alpha, which is this enormous background check for every job, every phone number you've ever had, back in the days when if you moved, you got a new phone number, every address you ever had, every friend that you ever had. It took hours to fill these things out.
Yeah. If you think that filling out your tax form is a problem, we have both filled these forms out, and there's nothing worse.
Yeah, and then initial interviews with the government psychologists.
Correct.
And lie detector tests, polygraphs, which are incredibly, incredibly stressful undertakings. In which, you cannot fool a polygraph, right? This is nonsense. And it took months to get hired by the NSA, and the police department was certainly less than that, but equal. When it came time, when the war started and I wanted to get involved, and I should probably say that I supported the invasion of Iraq, the initial invasion of Iraq. And so I felt that because I supported it, I had an absolute obligation to be a part of it. I couldn't re-enlist because of the heart condition, and there were other positions that I couldn't take. And the NSA wasn't quite, even though I'd been hired by the NSA, it would have taken at least a year or two before I had qualified to get over to Iraq. And at that point, in late 2003, the belief was that the war would be over in a few weeks or a few months. So many of us were just desperate to get over there as fast as we could. And the fastest way that I could do that was was contracting companies who did not offer physicals. And so I submitted my resume online. There was a website called monster.com, which is still out there. They called a few days later based on the resume, a 5-minute phone conversation, and I was hired. And that was it. There were no calls to the police department. There were no calls to the NSA. There were no forms to fill out other than, you know, some tax forms. And that was it. And I there was another phone call with the hiring manager the next day where I thought there'd be a bigger interview. And he simply, you know, I remember specifically, he picked it up and said, "Hey, you know, I hear you're the new interrogator. When are you leaving?" And that was it. And I was, I resigned the NSA position. They were good enough to, they encouraged me to go because they knew it'd be a good experience. I left the NSA within a few days, and I was in Iraq about 3 weeks later.
Okay. Well, now we've got you in Iraq, and you're an interrogator. Actually, a BLI-trained linguist who has been blessed to be an interrogator. And as you begin these interrogations, you begin having doubts about the number and quality of the detainees at Abu Ghraib, doubts about the effectiveness of the interrogation program, doubts about the presence of chemical weapons, doubts about the security of the prisons. Can you tell us just about what you were seeing during these times?
Yeah, I've answered this question so many times, and maybe some of you have heard me answer this question. I don't even know what we were seeing, and I'm not sure that anyone knew what we were seeing. And this also gets to the issue of what qualified someone to be an interrogator and whether or not we were qualified. No one over there was qualified to be an interrogator in that environment. The Army had, the military, the U.S. government, the U.S. country had never done anything like this.
That's right.
I did not have the formal military interrogation training, but that interrogation training, which I was familiar with, was largely based on the role of a debriefer. And so the idea that you would interrogate either lower ranking soldiers or even higher ranking soldiers, and based on unit information, what unit had they been in, what positions had they held, how high was their morale? What kind of equipment were they using? And so that higher level commanders could get a sense for what was out there that they may come in contact with. But at Abu Ghraib, we were dealing largely with prisoners that we had really no idea why they had been brought in or who they were. We had disbanded the Iraqi army, so we were not interrogating them as soldiers. We were interrogating them as insurgents. And so the initial question was chemical weapons. In early 2004, there was still this belief that there were chemical weapons. So every prisoner had to be questioned about chemical weapons. It became immediately clear that none of these people had really any idea about any of that stuff. And it was becoming clear that chemical weapons did not exist in Iraq the way that we were told they did. But then it also became clear that we had no handle on what Iraq really was, and who was there, and how they interacted with each other. And you may know the difference between a Sunni and a Shia, but there are 50 different storylines within the Sunni communities, and 1,000 different within the Shia communities. And it would have taken someone years, their entire life spent living in Iraq, and still they would not have had a grasp on what it did. So the task was simply, it was an impossible one from the beginning.
Okay. Can you describe the hard site? You talk a lot about it in the book.
Yeah, I tend not to describe it physically because the photos are out there and, and people can see it. But I had seen things, so I began my interrogations in a plywood interrogation facility outside of the hard site, and then eventually got pulled into the hard site. I spoke Arabic, and so I was, many interrogators wanted me to come into their interrogations, quite frankly, to make sure that their interpreters were being effective. Many of the interpreters did not speak the Iraqi dialect. Some of them were places from places like Somalia, in which was almost a completely different version of Arabic. Yep. And so the interrogators had doubts, and so they would often call me in to sit on interrogations just to sort of view the interpreter. This was the case in the hard site. And the hard site, you know, we talk a lot about enhanced interrogation and the difference between enhanced interrogation and torture, and are they the same thing? And then there's this issue of the photographs from Abu Ghraib that appeared on 60 Minutes. And I think what America has failed to confess and failed to realize is that the photographs that you see on the internet are what enhanced interrogation looked like. And so that was what Abu Ghraib looked like. And there was an expectation, you know, the enhanced interrogation program was written up, we saw it, we knew what the rules were, and that's how it was implemented. And so we were shocked, not by the photos when they were exposed, but we were shocked by the reaction of both the administration and also the American people, because this is what enhanced interrogation looks like.
Yes. You were asked to go to Fallujah because of your Arabic language skills. There you encounter the Palestinian chair. And could you describe its use? Just describe it first, then its use.
So Fallujah was on a much smaller scale than Abu Ghraib. The idea was that many of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib had been there for weeks or even months in some cases. And if they had intelligence value, it was old and in many ways useless at that point. So the idea was to go out to these forward units and interrogate on the actual battlefield as these individuals were captured. And when we arrived in Fallujah, it was the 82nd Airborne at the time, we immediately walked into the room and got the briefing, and the initial briefing by the lieutenant, and there was a small chair over in the corner, about 2 feet tall, made of plywood, with zip ties tied to the back, and it had written on it, Palestinian chair. Now, there's been a lot made about this use of the Palestinian chair, and that this means that the Israelis were teaching us how to, and that's not the case. There was a rumor that it had come from the Israelis, but the rumor went on to say that the Israelis had actually found it in a Hamas safe house, and certainly Hamas would have said that it came from the Israelis, and none of that matters, right? This was an American issue. This was an American interrogation room. This was an American torture device that we were talking about. And the Palestinian chair, which I also call it the torture chair, was designed for a stress position called confined spaces, which was an approved technique. Confined spaces you may think of as putting someone in a small box, but in this case, the chair was designed to confine someone into a cramped position from which they couldn't recover and put them in muscle failure.
Some of our political leaders have talked about reinstituting waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation techniques. Would you define that as torture, waterboarding?
I had a really, really interesting discussion yesterday with a high school group, two of the students who just spoke here yesterday. And I started by asking, had they ever seen photos of Abu Ghraib? And in the morning, not a single hand went up.
Yeah.
I've talked to high school and college groups before, and the numbers differ, but they're usually low. This was the first time I had encountered that no one had seen them. And so we started to talk about waterboarding. And I know that had I been asked as a high school student back in the 1980s, whether or not waterboarding was torture, almost every hand in the classroom would have gone up. And so I asked this class whether or not waterboarding was torture, and not many hands went up. We can talk about waterboarding and all the different ways that it is, but if we're going to talk about what torture really is and what constitutes torture, it's important to recognize that the worst torture that I saw, which was eventually in Fallujah a few weeks later, was sleep deprivation.
Yes.
And sleep deprivation was not a case of someone being deprived of sleep for a matter of weeks or months or sleep deprivation is accomplished in a matter of hours, and a prisoner could be put in a cell with no windows, so no idea of whether it's morning or evening or afternoon, allowed to go to sleep, and then allowed to sleep for an hour, even 45 minutes, and then woken up, kept awake for 10 or 15 minutes, and then put back to sleep, let to sleep for half an hour, and then woken back up. And repeat this over the course of 4 or 5 hours, and you have stripped them of the ability to recognize not only where they are, but when they are, and in some ways who they are. More importantly, what you've done is you've stripped them of their own will. And when you strip them of their own will, there's something you have to put in that place, and that's where you put your will in there. That's torture. That when you make That insertion as an interrogator, when you insert yourself and replace their will with yours, you have tortured them. You can do that without ever laying a hand on someone, without ever waterboarding, without ever physically injuring. And so that's the discussion. If we're going to have discussions about torture, we have to at least be honest about what it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, that brings me to the next question, because, you know, as an interrogator, what kind of training or instruction did you get either from the Army or from the folks managing your contract that would describe the limits of what an interrogator could do?
Well, there was no training from the contracting company. The expectation from the contracting company was that we were interrogators, right? This is how the contracting company approved us to work. But it's also worth noting that even Army-trained interrogators or Marine-trained interrogators had not been trained on enhanced techniques. None of the schools, whether it was at Fort Huachuca for the Army, and I don't actually know where the Marines interrogators were trained, but they had not implemented the enhanced training program in terms of this. So the only place you might experience this was a school that I was in the Army. It was called SEER School, which stood for Survive, Evade, Resist, and Escape. And I worked for a unit with the 101st Airborne Division, which had a high risk of capture in the event that we went to war. And so you qualified for this school. And the point was to expose you to the kind of torture that you would face from a foreign government. That course was re-engineered by two Army psychologists named Mitchell and Jessen, one of whom has a book out now, James Mitchell. And that was the foundation for what became this this enhanced program.
Yeah, I think Mitchell made about $81 million,
they became wealthy.
They became very wealthy. I think they're also hiring a lot of lawyers right now as well.
Yeah. They also live overseas.
Yes.
It's worth knowing.
How much do you believe that the senior officers knew about inappropriate interrogation techniques at Abu Ghraib and Fallujah?
Well, and this is an excellent question, and this is where it's going to be your turn to talk. You know, you and I have had long conversations about this. I want to be really careful about excusing myself from my own behavior. So my own narrative, if you buy the book, and I know that Anne will not be happy to say this, I don't recommend the book. It's an ugly story. But if you do, you'll see that I make a real focus to, it's not about policy, it's not about the Bush administration, it's not about some of the bigger issues we're talking about. It's about my own behavior and my own failures and things that I feel obligated to face. That being said, in the bigger narrative, and because I do have friends who are at Abu Ghraib that I still defend and I still feel a certain connection to, you know, you've talked about what you did at Guantanamo, right, and the kind of things you instituted. Had there been an officer similar to you at Abu Ghraib who had said to me and some of the other interrogators from the start, we will not do that, and that is not the way, I guarantee, and I can't claim much here, but I guarantee I'd have followed that in a heartbeat. And I was desperate for a voice that would have said that. It wasn't there, and maybe you can explain your voice.
I think I can help here, Eric. And I asked that question for a reason, because I was the first commander at Guantanamo, and probably drove my staff and everybody that worked for me crazy, because I would drive myself to the detention facility in the middle of the night, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and walk around throughout the entire camp, watching what was going on, talking to young soldiers and young Marines, asking them what they were seeing, finding out what they were thinking, trying to gauge what they thought the limits of their job were and what their responsibilities were, and to include the fact that if I was uncomfortable with some of them were sent home. And I think that is a responsibility of senior officers, and it's one of the reasons I asked the question. You know, Eric, you talk about your last interrogation in Iraq. And he was the fat man, the former high-ranking Ba'ath Party member who controlled the work line outside the gate. And you describe a completely different kind of interrogation that day. It is successful, meaning he gave you information that was useful. You say, this is the interrogator I should have been. I could have left Iraq with my soul intact. It's too late for that. Why don't you think you used those techniques earlier?
Well, God, I wish I had. And again, I'm careful about excuses here. But boy, again, what I wouldn't have done for a voice at Abu Ghraib giving me a different direction. I had seen and participated in sleep deprivation in Fallujah, and I knew immediately that You know, there's a question about when I knew I had crossed a line. I don't know. I have no idea. It might be the day that I took the job as an interrogator. There were so many lines that were crossed. But the clear memory is my first involvement and only involvement in sleep deprivation. I was on the night shift. Another interrogator was conducting the sleep deprivation, and he'd asked me to keep this prisoner awake during the evening. I'd gone into his cell for the very first time to wake him up. There was a schedule on the wall when I was supposed to do this. And it was a dark room. I turned on the lights. He had a robe on. I had him stand up. I was told to have him take off his robe. It was cold in Fallujah at the time, so just sort of keep him awake for a few minutes. And he was naked underneath the robe. And I didn't know that. And it was an immediate indication that I had committed essentially a crime in some ways, a crime against humanity. And I immediately put him back to sleep. Got him warm. Shut off the light. And I never again. That was the last time I ever did anything with enhanced or even aggressive interrogation. I returned back to, at that point, I had been assigned another position anyway. I returned back to Baghdad. It was counterintelligence, which is a fancy name for, I walked amongst the day workers that were coming onto Camp Victory, trying to decide who was good, who was bad, who belonged there, who didn't. And so I spent a few weeks observing these guys, and they would line up in the morning. And depending on where they lined up, and there were hundreds of them, depending on where they lined up, they could get better jobs if they were first. And so clearly you wanted to be first. And there's one individual, a large Iraqi man, who always was first in line, but was never the first to arrive. And no one complained when he walked to the front of the line. And then I also observed that he was able, as other people arrived late, he would put them not necessarily next to him, but in other places in the line. He knew where everyone belonged in that line. And when there were disputes in the line and he intervened, the dispute ended immediately. And so I recognized immediately this was somewhat of influence. And so I spoke to I interviewed other workers, just spoke to them cordially. At this point, my Arabic was pretty strong. And it became really clear really fast that he had been a really high-ranking member in the Ba'ath Party, had been very influential, had been very abusive. I only had to speak to him once or twice just to kind of background check some of the information, or double check some of the information that others had provided. And I wrote what, as you're mentioning, was my absolute most productive intelligence report, revealing who this guy was. Had we done that from the beginning, had we arrived at Abu Ghraib and just been allowed to observe and told to learn to learn the culture, to learn the history, to learn what was going on, to use, for the few of us that spoke Arabic, to use our language, you know, I'm not suggesting that we would have changed the overall arc of the Iraq War, which I think in some ways was doomed from the start, but I think we'd have a much, much different narrative about what had happened back then and what's happening now.
Well, you finished up your first tour, you went back to work with NSA, and then later on, you returned to Iraq. Why did you go back?
The first experience, you know, my expectation of war, as naive as I was that I would somehow be able to square it with my own values, my own principles, and in particular my Christian faith. And I wasn't. It was a disaster, as I should have known. Though it's worth noting that no one in the church had suggested that would happen. And so when I got home, two things. There were two reasons that I went back. One was a desperate attempt to redeem the experience of war. This belief that I could go back and I could do war in an honorable way. That if I went back and I didn't do interrogation, but I went with the NSA, which is signals intelligence, I could somehow find my war that I would eventually be proud of and move on. The second was the addiction to war. War is just, there are no words for it. But the adrenaline rush is unparalleled. Yeah,
what Eric's talking about is something we see with many of our young Marines and soldiers and other service members out there. And what we call them is adrenaline junkies. You get to the point where that level of heightened stress and fear and excitement is necessary every single day. And when these folks come back to their homes, their families in the States, they need it and they go back.
Yeah, well, and nothing seemed interesting, right? Yeah. So no longer, it wasn't interesting to make a shopping list, and it wasn't interesting to mow the lawn, and it was depressing in some ways. And so those two things were working. So I returned, and the second experience was in some ways worse than the first. Much of that section is redacted in the book because I worked for the NSA.
The whole book does not look like that, but there is a chapter where you're going to have to...
Those are the easy chapters to read.
Yeah.
And in honesty, the redactions, which are even certain entire pages disappear, It makes it look far more nefarious than it actually was. It, you know, in many ways, when the publisher received this, they were thrilled. I mean, our publishers are thinking about how to get people's interest, and right, this makes because the section really, excuse me, wasn't that interesting. But it was my attempt to suggest that no matter what experience I had in war, and I was trying to write how this one was even less interesting, it was somehow still more severe, and still based on what I saw and what I'd seen. And so, no, I mean, the act of war was not redeemable. And maybe you have a different experience with that, and maybe what you saw at Guantanamo or your time in Iraq is different. But for me, I could not find a way to bring anything, to redeem it, to bring anything good out of it.
Yeah.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Michael Leonard's conversation with Eric Fair.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Today's guest is Eric Fair, author of Consequence, a memoir. He is talking with retired General Michael Leonard, a Marine Corps veteran who was the first commander of the Guantanamo prison.
You return home, and your heart's giving out. You haven't told anybody. You're drinking too much, and your wife, Karen, who, by the way, when you read this book, she is a candidate for sainthood, and I'm not kidding, I'm not trying to be funny or anything else. This is a remarkable woman. You write, "An easy death scares me. I want to die in Iraq. I want to die like Ferdinand." Ferdinand was a close friend, and what appears in the book, a very fine man, and he was killed by a suicide bomber. You say that would have been fair. Do you think you still have a debt to pay?
Yeah, debt is there are so many words that will eventually steer towards issues of forgiveness and redemption and debts. And I know is that it's not something I can walk away from. And it's not something that, and it's not something really anyone should walk away from. It's not something the nation gets to walk away from, which is, I think, what we've done. I don't know if it's a debt that we have to pay, but there's absolute work to do. And I saw that yesterday in the classroom with the high school students. And it's no fault of their own, right? I'm not condemning them for not knowing this stuff. But the fact that this history, and it's not just being altered, right? So there are different opinions, and there are people that we could bring up on the stage with that would absolutely disagree with not necessarily the facts here, but my conclusions, and that's fair. But we can't have it disappear, which is what I saw yesterday. We can't not know that these things happened. And we can't simply walk away from this thinking that we did not have an enormous interrogation. We talk about Guantanamo Bay a lot, as we should,
right.
And it's critical. But as you was, the max numbers were less than 1,000.
Yeah, there were 780 individuals sent to Guantanamo Bay. Most of them were sent back without any action and are currently living semi-normal lives in either the country they came from or one of the 56 countries we sent them to.
Yeah, and so when I arrived at Abu Ghraib, the numbers were really unclear because we couldn't process them. The minimum number is 7,000.
Yeah.
It was possibly as high as 12 or 15,000, which is to say nothing of a history that has also disappeared. I occasionally hear from other military police, and not often interrogators, but analysts, who have seen some of the things that I have seen and want to speak publicly about it. And don't know how and how to get started. And I often warn them not to be careful. But all of them, every single one, comes from Bagram Airfield, right? Which is an interrogation facility and history that we know nothing about. So again, I have an agenda, of course, like anyone, but my obligation, whether we're talking about debt or not, it's an absolute obligation to tell these stories.
Well, you know, you told the story perhaps the first time when it really got a lot of attention, when you wrote the article for the Washington Post. And you talk about how you received more than 3,000 emails, many of them abusive.
Sure.
And are you still receiving hate mail pieces for either that piece you wrote or for this book?
Well, when I wrote the piece in 2007 for the Washington Post, they recommended that I publish my email at the bottom of the piece. Now, this was the advent, in many ways, of the comment sections for newspapers online. And there was already this knowledge that people could get ugly in the comment section and that the word internet troll was just coming into being. But the thought process was that this was a worthwhile conversation and that people would engage. And so I remember the piece publishes at midnight on the Washington Post site. So my wife and I, Karen, were sitting up in bed looking at our computers, and 12 a.m. the piece comes up. 12:01 a.m., 35 new emails. 12:02, 56 new emails, 120 new emails. And they flooded in uncontrollably. Now, many were supportive. I won't suggest they were. But others were incredibly violent. And they came from both sides, right? And so there were both conservative voices that said I should die, and there were absolute progressive and liberal voices that said I should die. Some of that has dissipated over the last decade, but a lot of that has to do with the fact that I don't publish my email anymore. Right. And I've learned my lesson. It often takes me time to learn, but I did learn that lesson. And I'm careful about I don't do a lot of events. I did not do a book tour. There are requests, and many of them go ignored. I can't quite say why this one jumped out, but I'm glad I came, and it's been an amazing discussion. But it remains a critical issue, and I feel obligated to speak about it at times. But I'm a little bit more protective of right. both me and my family.
Well, you've mentioned that many individuals wrote to you and told you that you should die, and your wife Karen becomes pregnant. You have a son. And at the same time, you write, you feel you've interfered with the lives of too many people. And you write, my son is 2 days old when I hear my first call to suicide. You leave the seminary. You were briefly in the seminary. This relationship between you and Karen is tough. What should be a time of hope and happiness seems to be just the opposite. So your heart's failing on top of that. You've hit pretty much what I sensed when I read the book was that this was pretty much rock bottom. Was this the worst time for you?
It was a bad time. I've gotten to the point now where I don't talk about I don't know what the worst time is, right? Yeah. I don't know that if I'm going up or going down, I'm not sure where it goes. I know the issue of suicide gets talked about a lot. And the issue of suicide wasn't for me that I had reached this point of hopelessness or I just didn't want to go on anymore or I'd lost all purpose. The call to suicide for me came out of the same thing that in many ways sent me back to Iraq that second time, which was a sense that because I was a little dysfunctional at this point and I wasn't interacting with Karen well, so I wasn't so sure I was going to interact with my son well, and so it felt like an obligation. Like that was the way to finish the project, essentially, was to kill myself. It was in many ways that because I wanted to go on and because I felt like I wanted to be happy, that I felt like the only way the right thing or the right response to that based on what I had done was to end that. I didn't feel like I had a right to be happy. So those were the initial calls to that. But I have an incredibly supportive family and a good friend structure. And so there were, I think for any veteran, and you can speak to this as well, there are ups and downs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So locating the actual basement or the valley, I don't tend to do that anymore because I don't know where that is.
Yeah, I'll just kind of reinforce what Eric's saying. War is a morally bruising event, and there is only one type of individual who is not changed through the process of going to war, and those are high-functioning sociopaths, and you don't want to go to war with somebody like that. And I'm not trying to be funny or anything else. We've heard a lot of talk about post-traumatic stress, and that certainly happens. There's also what can happen at the same time or to other people is what I call post-traumatic growth. That trauma causes you to think and reflect and grow stronger. But you will be changed. You will be changed fundamentally, and you can't go back.
And I'd like to say there's something interesting also about, we talk about Karen and how amazing she was, and she was. But she, I didn't write her well, and she talks to me about this a lot. because she often, when I speak to groups, she often comes across that way as sort of as the hero. And she doesn't want to be seen that way, because she made mistakes too. And she's had a really hard road as well, and she hasn't always performed up to her own standards based on on the war experience. And so I have to be careful, because if we come in and we talk about Karen as kind of the hero of the story, then my fear is that the message to other military spouses, whether they be wives or husbands, is that you have to be the rock, right? And Karen does not feel like she was the rock. Yeah. And she, so there were things that I certainly could have written in there that where she really bugged me, or I really felt like she failed me, right? And we've had discussions in which she has confessed and said, I absolutely failed you in those areas. And I wish you had put those in the book, because it would have made me more human. So yeah. I have great respect for that, and she does too. And I think it's fair to say that she really was an amazing person. But as we talk about how relationships survive or how relationships navigate these kind of things, no one performs well. I mean, there's no way to navigate this in a heroic manner. It's just ugly.
I think one thing that we can say with some level of consistency is that if you go to war or spend a long time in the military and still have the same spouse that you started with, that you have been fortunate enough to have been married to a remarkable person. And yes, there are ups and downs, but most people I know that have been married for a long time speak of their spouse, both men and women, with a certain level of awe. Quite often not in front of them, but...
And it's probably worth saying, if you go to war, your spouse goes to war.
Absolutely. Absolutely, without doubt. I'm going to ask you to talk briefly, very briefly, about something that the audience needs to know, because we talked about your heart failing. Well, someone died, and you got their heart, and you're walking around with it today. And can you talk briefly about that? And then I'm going to ask you to read a short passage from your book, and then we're going to bring the lights up and we're going to ask for questions. So please talk a little bit about that heart transplant.
Yeah, so, you know, there are entire books written about heart transplant, and some really, really good ones. And that was, when I first submitted the book to the publisher, I didn't include the heart transplant, and I'd actually just gotten out of the hospital, and they encouraged me to put that in there. And that's I'm 3 years out now from my heart transplant, or almost three. It was July. And you know, I almost died. Or, yeah. You know, I ended up in a hospital, and you go through different progressions in heart failure, and I felt what it was like to die, and I couldn't. On certain days I couldn't walk because my knee wouldn't work, and other days my arm wouldn't work, or I'd have trouble breathing, and you just feel your body shutting down. And I eventually ended up in a hospital bed where they give you 30 or 60 days, and you're on the highest level of need. And the heart came in, and I was very lucky, and I've been very lucky since. And this issue of, there's this issue of celebrating the fact that you get a heart transplant and get to move on, but there's also this incredible sad issue that you get to move on because someone else died. And in many ways, that feels like the experience of war. You know, we talked about Ferdinand. As I continue to sort of work through what I've done and process these things, there are plenty of other people who don't get that opportunity,
right,
and have not had that opportunity. So the process for me continues. I'm not at the end of sort of the story, the book. I mean, every book has to end somewhere. Writers always talk about it's never finished, you just abandon it. And in many cases, that's what this book was. But, you know, the country is just at the beginning of this narrative. And it's called Consequence for a reason, because every time I have these discussions, the word consequence or consequences continues to come to the top. The consequences of what people like me did and what we as a nation did in places and are doing in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, we don't know yet. And some of them are unavoidable at this point.
Eric, I'm going to ask you to read one paragraph here that... In fact, you probably know where it is.
Yeah.
You wrote the book.
So much of the book is about my faith continues to show up. My upbringing in the Presbyterian Church, and in many ways, my grandmother was a pivotal figure in my life. And she lived to be 97 and was very healthy and eventually died. And so this is near the end of the book. Not long after my grandmother died, Don Hackett, who had been my youth pastor in the Presbyterian Church, so not long after my grandmother died, Don Hackett asked me whether I still prayed. I do not. But unlike those mornings at Abu Ghraib when I avoided prayer in order to ignore my own failures, I avoid it now because I have a debt to pay, and I have no right to petition someone else to pay it. I am a torturer. I have not turned a corner or found my way back. I have not been redeemed, and I have no right to expect that I ever will be. But I'm still obligated to try.
And with that, I'd like to bring up the house lights, and let's take some questions. And I'm going to ask each of you that asks a question, please, since this is being taped, make sure you use the microphone. And okay, we've got someone right there with the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question about the effectiveness of enhanced interrogation techniques. A couple years ago, the International Affairs Forum brought Charlie Dolfer here to speak, and he was in charge of the effort to find WMD in Iraq. And after we went in, he was actually part of the team that was interrogating Saddam Hussein and Tariq Aziz and all the high-level people. Well, they didn't use enhanced interrogation methods on Saddam Hussein, and they got all this information from him. And so, it's really kind of a two-part question. So why at the lower level, who made that decision? Where did it come from? Where in the U.S. government did it make the decision to use those techniques? And then, who was thinking that it worked?
Okay, so where it came from, I'm going to look left, to my left. Yeah. And whether it works, then I'll come back to...
Yeah. First off, the decision to use enhanced interrogation techniques started in the White House. And there was a lawyer by the name of Yu who wrote a very lawyerly piece that expressed that enhanced interrogation techniques were not torture, that fact that we were applying interrogation on these individuals was acceptable because they were not legitimate combatants, which in that case would have been a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And it was an amazing piece of lawyering. Okay? I'm not a lawyer. But it managed to avoid the fact that the U.S. is a signatory to the Geneva Conventions. Now, some of you out there that perhaps think that torture or enhanced interrogation techniques are all right, I'm going to anticipate a question here. I was often asked by young Marines and soldiers, they would say, "General," and this takes a lot of guts for a 22-year-old Marine or soldier to ask a general a question, but like I told you, I was out there in the middle of the night talking to them. And they'd say, "General, why are we treating them so well? They wouldn't treat us this way." And I would always respond, I'd say, "Corporal, Lance Corporal, Private, you're absolutely correct. But your point's irrelevant. Because if we treat them as they would treat us, we become them." And I'm afraid that by going down this slippery slope, we are becoming them. The objectives of terrorists are to do two things: to make us live in fear and to change us. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't intend to live my life in fear. But if you wake up every morning because you're afraid of something, then you just let them win.
And now the bad news. As for the issue about whether torture works, it does. And a better answer is it can. And I've seen it, and I've used it, and I've watched it. And every individual, if I were to interrogate every individual in this room and use the exact same process of interrogation, you would all respond differently. Some of you would tell me your life stories. Some of you would never say a word. So every individual is different. The application, and we talked about kind of finding a way to insert your will. That can be done in a very cordial manner. You can either trick someone, or someone may just want to work with you based on the fact that they look at the country and it's a country whose values are something they want to emulate, and it's a nation they want to help, right? This is what we want out of prisoners of war. We want them to help us. But in Abu Ghraib, with certain prisoners, a slap or a shove or something like sleep deprivation, applied at the right time, could convince people to give up information. And they gave up information that they were denying originally that could be verified later, right? It worked on an incredibly limited scale. And the overall failure of our entire war policy, be it Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria, is evidence that the program was in a large scale a failure. But if you get into a discussion with someone about whether or not we should use these techniques, whether they call them torture or enhanced interrogation, and you base your entire point on the fact that torture doesn't work because people who haven't used torture tell you it doesn't work, you will never convince them. This is the problem we have with the current administration. There are people telling him it works, and he's already convinced. And so we need to instead be talking about the things that Mike is talking about, that it doesn't matter if it works. Right? Of course it works. This is exactly why we shouldn't be using it. Right? Torture works because it dehumanizes and destroys a person. And this is not who we are as a nation. So I'm really careful, and I really I plead with people not to use that as a discussion or a talking point in terms of whether or not this is something. Because if someone is convinced that it works, either they've seen it or been told, you're not gonna convince them otherwise.
We have a question here.
Question?
Eric and Mike, thank you for a great presentation this evening. I have a very specific question based on the fact that you have alluded to issues of conscience. The lawyerly piece that was written showed little conscience. The process that you went through to get your job as a contractor with a five-minute phone call or apparently showed little conscience about you being drafted to do that sort of work. And your experience with the high school kids shows that maybe perhaps as a nation we've lost our conscience on this issue. Are there other people who feel the same way you do? And maybe more specifically, are there enough other people who feel the same way that you do?
Yes, and I hope so. So there is a lobbying group, right? We think bad immediately. But there's a lobbying group in Washington, D.C. called Human Rights First, actually has its headquarters in New York City. But both Mike and I are part of this lobbying group, as are a number of former generals, CIA agents, FBI agents, Army interrogators, Marine Corps interrogators, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, Democrats, all together who feel really strongly that this is not something that reflects the values of the country. And we have spoken in congressional offices and Senate offices. Some spoke to President Obama. I hope they get a chance to speak to President Trump. So there are there is a significant body of voices of people with significant experience who think this way.
Yeah.
But it is not universal.
Yeah, there's about 120 senior generals and admirals that have signed on to a letter with Human Rights First saying that torture is just plain wrong. If we can, let's see, we'll get the mic over there, I guess, and then you, sir, we'll get you next, okay? There's a gentleman. Oh, we've got one over here, and then we'll work it out. All right. We'll get to you, sir. Go ahead.
Mr. Fair, I want to thank you, too, for coming tonight and sharing your story and your book. One of the things that you talked about is that we need to keep talking about this, particularly with our kids, and having them understand the way things are when it's real easy to push it under the rug. One of the things that we like to do in this country is everybody that's been in the service and comes home or doesn't come home is a hero. And it seems to me that that's one way that we put up the screen.
Yeah.
If everybody's a hero, then we talk about heroic things.
Yeah.
And that's always intrigued me why, when I read about Second World War veterans or talk to them, usually they don't want to talk about it.
Right.
And we've never really encouraged them to do that. And we get feeling like that's not the territory we need to walk on. And we do that by everybody's a hero. And I don't think I want to go up to everybody that's come back and said, thanks for your service. I mean, I want to thank you for telling your story. I don't know if I want to thank you for your service.
Well, and I think it's okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm done. That the way we cover up
sure.
and don't want to talk about this is really a big issue.
And I think it's okay to thank veterans for service, and because I don't want to get into this idea that we should accuse them upon arrival of having done things. But history is also very clear within the Christian Church. You know, during the Crusades, the Catholic Church had really specific penance set up for soldiers that came back from the Crusades. They were not welcomed back as heroes. They were welcomed back as sinners. Right? The expectation was that the war was necessary. It was a necessary sin, right? And they now you come back. So if you had killed someone, you did this much penance. If you'd killed two people, this. If you thought that maybe you had killed someone, if you'd fired an arrow and not seen where it landed, then right. And there were really specific things in place. We don't have that, right? So there is no space to come back and an expectation that we went to war and did horrible things. The expectation is that we went and did heroic things. And the issue of World War II veterans, there's a scene in the book in which I'm back from my second tour, back home now, and there's an older gentleman on the block who needs his air conditioner removed for the winter. And so I get called in to help, and someone says, Frank's a World War II veteran, you guys should go talk. You know, you'll have a lot to talk about. Frank never talks about it. And so they go off to get the air conditioner, and Frank and I sit in there, and Frank says, well, of course I don't talk about World War II, right? I was a bombardier on a B-17, and I dropped incendiaries on Germany, and I killed hundreds, if not thousands. Why would I talk to anyone about that? And so if the expectation is that you come back and have heroic good stories, and what you really want to say is that I damaged human souls, to include my own and others, and my intention was to hurt people, and I shot a 12-year-old boy because he was those aren't stories that people are giving you the opportunity to tell if they're celebrating you at football games. So you make an excellent point. I think it's okay to say thanks for the service, but we have to change the narrative. The expectation has to be that if you send someone off to war, you break them. And there is no other excuse. The war may be necessary. I'm not a pacifist, but we have to have a national conversation that says we're going to go to war and we're going to break some of our kids and we're not going to fix them. Is it worth it?
Okay. Okay. One more question.
Are you familiar with a book by Mark Thiessen, who was part of the Bush administration? George W. Bush, in which he justifies enhanced interrogation or any other books or articles in that vein? And how would you answer them, or have you ever debated anybody on that side of the issue?
Yeah, so Mark Thiessen is he's a columnist for the Washington Post, and he has been incredibly supportive of the torture program, the enhanced program. Not long after I wrote a piece for the New York Times, Fox News did a piece on me that essentially had talked about how I had initially talked about what I had done was enhanced interrogation, and I felt bad for that, but I later used the word torture, and so that was evidence that I had made the whole thing up. And then they ended the piece by saying that while nothing Eric Fair said was factually wrong, his general overall tone leads to questions, right? And Mark Thiessen was very quick to retweet that and make some comments about how that, you know, boom, Eric Fair, the Abu Ghraib liar, has been exposed, right? And so there's this desperation not to deal with differing opinion, right? They are absolutely convinced and certain that what they did is right. And on some level, I've held that opinion, and so it's not so much that I respect it as I can empathize with it. I know what it is to be that afraid, and I know what it is to feel that certain that you're right. And so there are still a large percentage of voices that think this is the right thing to do. And they're very easily, you know, what got us there first was 9/11, right? We can't just ignore where the country was post 9/11 and the mindset and the large percentage of people that had you asked, you know, Vice President Dick Cheney went on Meet the Press and said that we have to work in the shadow, we have to take the gloves off, we have to do, and no one questioned him. This is what it looks like. And it's not who we are. So there are other voices out there, and I don't want them dismissed. I want them heard, and I want to have an open debate.
All right. Well, I believe that concludes the event for tonight.
Thank you.
That was Eric Fair talking with Michael Leonard. Eric Fair's book is Consequence, a Memoir. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.